When Wayne Fredericks wakes up in Osage, Iowa, one of the first things he does is check the price of soybeans.
Well, I'm just looking at my screen right now. Cash soybeans are $7.82 at my local elevator for current delivery, $7.86 for fall. Cash corn, $3.10, and for fall, $3.22.
And that's a lot lower than he'd like.
Well, we feel that we got to be in excess of $9, you know, just to break even. You know, profits start in above that, depending on yields. So we're a long ways away.
That's because on July 6th, President Donald Trump implemented a 25% tariff on U.S. soybean imports into China, and China turned to other buyers. Many farmers say they're feeling the consequences of the president's trade war. On Tuesday, the Trump administration took steps to curb that pain. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today, a look at the Department of Agriculture's $12 billion in emergency aid relief to protect American farmers. I spoke to Wayne Fredericks, the soybean farmer from Osage. He's also been on the American Soybean Association's board of directors since 2015, and Anna Swanson, a reporter covering trade for The New York Times, about what this relief means. And I asked Anna, is $12 billion a lot of money here, relatively speaking?
Well, it is a lot of money, up to $12 billion of direct payments, product purchases, and other funding that would go to American farmers who have been hurt by the trade war. And the goal is to offset some of the pain that farmers have been feeling from tariffs that countries, including China, Canada, the European Union, and Mexico have begun to impose on their products abroad.
So there's something a little wonky I want to see if you can help us explain for our listeners. A lot of the resources are coming from something called the Commodity Credit Corporation. What is that and how does that work?
That's right. So this is a Depression-era program. It's typically used to fund farm programs that are passed by Congress. But in this case, the Trump administration has taken kind of the unusual step of bypassing Congress. That money has already been approved, so they don't actually need congressional approval. And so they are able to channel this funding directly from the CCC, which is in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to American farmers.
Wayne, as a farmer and as someone who's sitting on this board, I'm wondering, do you and the farmers that you speak to need this relief package?
Well, I think it's imperative that something happened to show the farmers that they understand the pain we're going through out here in country. Yes, we're appreciative of the package, although I think it kind of tells us this thing's going to be drug out a lot longer than maybe we had hoped for. And that's the main concern that I see. Yes, we got farmers that are hurting pretty badly right now, especially if they've had to make some cash sales of product. You know, they're sitting on grain in storage that they were hoping to sell on a summer rally. And, you know, of course, after the tariffs went into effect on July 6th, that rally definitely disappeared. In fact, it went down as much as $2 a bushel for farmers, and that's taking them into a severe area of pain. So this will be helpful, and I think as farmers, we hope he's successful. We understand, you know, the inequities in trade that have accrued over the many years out there, and the worst thing that could happen would to, you know, walk away from this now and not succeed in achieving some of the balance of trade that this administration is hoping to achieve.
Anna, I want to turn back to you for a second about the political fallout. There were reports yesterday, anyone who was watching social media could see the fallout. And in particular, there were a couple of things that were said, including from folks in the GOP who compared this to a Soviet-type economy, criticizing this move. Tell us a little bit about the GOP reaction to this $12 billion aid package.
Yes, so the reaction was definitely mixed. There was a, you know, some positive reception from some Republican lawmakers and farm groups saying that this is a good temporary measure, and they're thankful that the president is doing something to help farmers who are struggling right now. However, many, many people in the Republican Party emphasized that this is not the long-term solution that they wanted to see. You had lawmakers calling this a self-inflicted wound or gold crutches. You know, of course, many of these Republican lawmakers come from more of a free market mindset. And so the idea of using taxpayer money to subsidize farmers, you know, for a policy that the president himself has brought on, and, you know, damage that the president himself has brought on to those communities, just really doesn't appeal to them in the longer term.
It just, Sandra, feels like this was a policy that the president enacted, and now it is failing the folks that that he was trying to protect in many ways. And now we're dipping into the, you know, my pockets and your pockets and everyone else's pocket to fix this. I mean, is this essentially a failure of the Trump tariff policies?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, as Wayne was saying before, you know, a lot of people would say it's a little early to tell yet, and they're still hoping that this is a negotiating strategy, that the tariffs are a bid to convince other countries to give the United States better terms of trade, better trade agreements. And that is what the administration maintains. They're currently renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. Also, some discussions going on with the Europeans here in Washington this week. And I think it really hinges on whether or not the Trump administration is able to produce those better deals. So far, we haven't seen the Trump administration successfully conclude, you know, one of these major deals that would expand markets. There was a deal with Korea that was announced earlier in the administration, but negotiations are still going on over NAFTA, and no deal with the Europeans as yet.
Again, but it just feels like this is a real subsidy at the cost of taxpayers, and I'm not sure if Americans quite understand that yet, but it just feels like we didn't have to get to this point.
No, I don't see it that way. I see the trade has been something that has been tremendous for agriculture. It's been tremendous for this country. But if there's inequity in trade, that's always a concern. And we recognize the inequities that have been out there, you know, towards specific industries. Agriculture happens to be the bright spot, that we always had surplus balance of trade. But we realize other industries were not in that boat and facing many inequities. So we've been supportive of correcting those inequities, and we feel that'll be better for the country in the long run. And I think we're on the verge of signing NAFTA. And I think, you know, the Korean trade deal has been successful. So I think you start to get one of these signed, I think they'll many of them will start to fall and come into place. But we need to, you know, continue to plunge forward, continue to negotiate, and continue to get some of these things done.
Anna, in terms of the long-term impacts that this could have on the farming industry, and Wayne, I'll pose this question to you as well. What do you see as the long-term effect of this type of aid package?
Well, I think the aid package will be helpful in the short term. There are some, you know, issues with dispensing the money. I mean, the Trump administration needs to figure out who's going to get what, and then there's a bit of a lag in terms of getting that money to the farmers. So, you know, hopefully they're doing okay to hold on in the meantime until that funding is dispersed. But in the longer run, I think there's a question about what the consequences of the trade war will be for the agricultural community. And, you know, even if these new deals are signed and they're better deals, in the meantime, you do have some purchasers in foreign countries that are switching away from American products and buying other foreign products. I was talking to a cheesemaker in Wisconsin recently who said that because of Mexican tariffs on their product, some of their customers were switching to European suppliers as well. So these markets have taken many years to develop in some cases. And some of those contracts are being lost. The question is just, you know, will they come back and how will that affect American farmers in the long run?
Wayne, do you see that as a long-term concern, you know, as far as, and potentially are you seeing other tariffs? Are you being impacted by, say, steel tariffs, for example? Are there other long-term concerns about potentially losing a customer base because of this?
Well, I think, you know, we had a lot of eggs in one basket, specifically with China. You know, they were buying a third of our soybeans. That's a huge customer. And it's going to take a lot of small customers to make up for that. But we realize that, you know, we need to diversify our market. And that is part of this aid package, is that there was going to be some money invested into to market enhancement, market growth, you know, market potential. And so they realize that, you know, we need to broaden that aspect. The steel tariffs, they're already affecting agriculture, raising the price of steel bands and buildings and farm machinery. So it's really slowed down the purchasing of these products out here.
Wayne Fredericks is a farmer from Osage, Iowa, and he's been on the American Soybean Association's board of directors since 2015. And Anna Swanson is a reporter covering trade for the New York Times. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
On Tuesday, a federal judge ordered the release of Pablo Villavicencio Calderon from immigration detention. Villavicencio is an undocumented immigrant from Ecuador, and ICE detained him last month after making a food delivery to a military base in Brooklyn, New York. Here to bring us up to speed on Villavicencio's release is Juan Manuel Benitez, host of Pura Política on Spectrum Noticias, New York One. Juan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tansina.
So, very interesting story here. Remind us about Pablo Vicencio Calderon, how he was detained by ICE. This was when he was making a food delivery in Brooklyn.
Correct. June 1st, he went to make a delivery at that army base. And like in many other occasions before, he presented his IDNYC, that municipal ID here in New York that many immigrants and many undocumented immigrants have, so they have a photo ID whenever they go to an official building. In that occasion, the official at the Army base didn't like that ID and just ran a background check on Villavicencio. And he discovered an outstanding deportation order from 2010. It's because he came into the country in 2008, and then in 2010, when his asylum application was denied, he voluntarily said, I'm going to leave the country. He never left. He never went back to Ecuador. And in 2013, he married Sandra Chica, now who is a naturalized citizen. Now he has two small daughters. They are also citizens of the United States. So the judge yesterday, and it was really remarkable to be in the courthouse yesterday, the federal courthouse. Judge Paul Crowdy, who is a George W. Bush appointee, he was extremely forceful with the government's lawyer. And he said things such as, the powerful are doing what they want, the poor are suffering what they must. Remember that Villavicencio didn't have a criminal record before. He just had that outstanding deportation order from 2010.
And should he have been protected because New York is a sanctuary city? Does that did that play any role in this at all?
Or? When it comes to an army base, that's a federal government jurisdiction. So it's really hard to make that case. However, the judge kept saying, this person doesn't have a criminal record. He has been paying taxes. He's a family man. He has a family who are all citizens of the United States in this case. So why is the government detaining him?
And what was their response? I mean, what was the government's case? Was it this outstanding deportation order that he had violated? What exactly were they trying to prove?
What's happening lately, and you know, Tansina, is that ICE is coming into communities, immigrant communities all over the country. And if you have a deportation order that you never complied with, then they're going to arrest you, and they're going to try to put you on the next flight back to your country, to the country where you were born. They've done that repeatedly, and that's what they tried to do also with Villavicencio. They couldn't do it because a few days after he was arrested on June 1st, a few days later, there was a stay on his deportation. Like a federal judge, another one in the same Southern District, said, wait a minute, we have to hear the case and what he has to say. And what Crotty, Judge Crotty, yesterday was trying to say is that he started the adjustment to regularize his status back in February of this year. Why don't you let him go through the process? And once that process is done, even if the government says we're not going to give you a green card, then just deport him, but give him due process.
And the judge actually did say, Crotty said, you know, quote, is there any concept of justice here? Which I thought was a pretty powerful thing to say in addition to what you were mentioning earlier.
It was. And yes, I was in the overflow room in the courthouse. It was packed with friends, supporters, lawyers. And every time the judge said something like this, everybody was cheering for the family, for Villavicencio. It's a really... You know, a lot of people can say, you know, this is the rule of law. We have to follow rules. We have to follow the law. But this country always shows some sort of compassion for stories like Villavicencio's, right? And people are seeing how the government just goes unchecked right now and how the messages from the White House are immigrants are bad. They are all gang members. And even when he goes to Europe, the president is saying immigrants are destroying the culture.
And I think what's so interesting about this case, too, is that, and maybe this is why it was tugging at a lot of people's heartstrings in New York, is that he did, as you mentioned, had an ID. Mm-hmm. He had a New York City identification card specifically issued for people who don't have more formal types of identification. He was working. Right?
Right.
He was working. He's married. He's a family man. I mean, all these things. And in fact, he was essentially outed when he was working. So I think that was one of the things that maybe made a lot of New Yorkers really passionate about this case.
And many people now are wondering, is the IDNYC now a liability for many immigrants? Because it happened also to Margarito and Concepcion Silva. Grandparents from Mexico, they've been in this country for 20 years. And on July 4th, they went to visit their son-in-law and they went to the Fort Drum Army base around the Buffalo area. They showed their IDNYC and they were detained as well. And they were really close to deportation and they were released a couple of days ago, again, by another judge saying, let's get them through the process first.
And this is an ID, once again, for our listeners who are outside of New York, that New York City and state created so that people could have ID, right? So that
many other cities in the country. Since the early 2000s, some cities in the country, because there's no resolution with immigration reform in Washington, they've been trying to give some sort of photo ID to these undocumented immigrants that are part of the communities all over the country, but who they are waiting for their chance to to regularize their immigration status.
Where do you see this going? What kind of message, if any, does this send about people like Villavicencio's?
I think for him, hopefully he'll have a chance to have due process and to go through the process and maybe get that green card that he wants. But the message here is that how many undocumented immigrants like Villavicencio right now are slipping through the cracks of this administration and their zero tolerance policy.
Because his case did get a lot of media attention.
Correct.
And he was detained for a little over a month, right? Waiting for this to happen.
Correct. And we know that there are so many cases like his all over the country. Many of them don't get the same media attention, but this is happening. And many immigrant communities all over the country are scared and fear that they might be next.
Juan Manuel Benitez is host of Pura Política on Spectrum Noticias, New York One. Juan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tansina.
120 years ago today, the United States military invaded the island of Puerto Rico. 2 months earlier, U.S. ships had blocked the San Juan Harbor. But on the 25th of July, 1898, the Americans, also known on the island as Estadounidenses, were officially coming ashore. Puerto Rico was targeted as part of the Spanish-American War, a war that came just 25 years after slavery was abolished on the island. And for many of the formerly enslaved islanders, the U.S. invasion was a moment that forced them to think deeply about their identities.
While my great-grandfather José and my grandfather Higinio had little loyalty toward the Spanish, they felt a deep and abiding love for the land they tilled.
That's author Esmeralda Santiago reading from an essay she's publishing today about the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico and the impact it had on her Puerto Rican ancestors.
Though some on the island prepared to fight alongside Spain, and a few welcomed the idea of a Puerto Rico Americano, Higinio, like his parents, was willing to kill and to die before allowing a foreigner to take his piece of Puerto Rico from him.
I sat down with Esmeralda to mark this anniversary.
Both my great-grandparents on both sides from my father's side were former enslaved people in the sugar haciendas of Puerto Rico. So in 1873, the emancipation came through, and so they were free to go wherever they wanted to go. But most of them decided to stay in the same general area where basically their families were. So my great-grandparents knew one another, and they stayed there. And my grandfather was in San Juan when the bombing began in May. So it was before the invasion. It was at the beginning of the Spanish-American War. And much to his surprise that he was going to San Juan to deliver some goods to the family of the hacendado that he learned that the United States was threatening the island with invasion.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the impact was when the United States finally did invade the island? There had to have been a cultural impact as well, right?
The first thing that the estadounidenses did was change the language, which was actually, it had to be repealed because the people would not accept it. The interesting thing about Puerto Ricanos of that period, they didn't necessarily love the Spaniards, but they had had 420 plus years of Spanish language and culture. And so they weren't quite willing to just give it all up in order to become estadounidenses. So it was, there was a great deal of pushback from the invasion armies. There was a lot of pushback that the culture not change. They could not fight them with the kinds of implements that they had to fight the American invasion, but they certainly wanted to preserve their culture as much as they could. And there was quite a bit of pushback from the imposition of language and laws and rules that the Puerto Ricanos just wouldn't have it.
And let's talk a little bit about the impact that it's had long term. Today, obviously, we are in a post-Maria moment, and we're coming up on the anniversary, one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria. But in addition to the hurricane, the island of Puerto Rico has also, and its people, including myself and millions of others, have gone through a number of changes, if you will, because of this U.S. Invasion. Can you tell us a little bit about what that history has done to Puerto Ricanos collectively?
What the invasion did collectively for Puerto Ricanos is to make our culture become second to the culture of the United States. And even though I think my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation and even my generation and the generation after really struggled to maintain as close as possible a sense of Puerto Rican-ness. But it becomes more difficult every day to maintain that culture because the media comes from outside, for example. The news comes from the outside. What's happening on the island doesn't get out of the island unless a major disaster like Maria comes up. In the United States, except for us, the Puerto Ricanos who live here, we are basically forgotten by the United States. And in spite of the many efforts that we've made, including insurrections, rebellions, violence against the government, we have not been able to get enough respect from the United States government to allow us to be the people that we are, which is Puerto Ricanos, from our very deepest part of ourselves. And I think that our culture has changed tremendously just in my generation. So I know that it's something that those of us who are getting older, of course, we're sad about that because we value our culture. Young people don't really know about these kinds of stories. They haven't heard about an invasion of a small island that had been struggling for independence. And just because a major power had bigger guns, they just decide, oh, I'll just take it. We need to let our children know that we didn't lay down to be invaded. We fought and we fought and we fought, and we're still fighting.
And as we mentioned earlier, the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria is quickly approaching. What should people be thinking about on this anniversary coming up?
I am very happy when people who are not Puerto Rican speak positively and encouragingly about Puerto Ricanos. I think it's really important that we don't forget that what happened in Puerto Rico was a disaster. It was a disaster that was not preventable because it was a hurricane. But it's really important to remember that it's not over. The disaster was so horrible and so devastating that it will be a process of many, many years for Puerto Ricanos to feel that they are at home. So I hope that as the anniversary comes, that people remember that and to do whatever they can to continue to help, to support the efforts to recover from the hurricane, and to be kind to those Puerto Ricanos who have had to leave the island, who maybe are now in a foreign land, in a foreign community, trying very, very hard to make a life when, in fact, they would have preferred to stay at home.
Esmeralda Santiago is the author of When I Was Puerto Rican and Conquistadora. Esmeralda, gracias. Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
To read Esmeralda Santiago's essay on the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico, visit thetakeaway.org. Have you ever been called lippy, difficult, angry, hot-headed, or told to watch your tone in the middle of a meeting? Well, then this segment is for you.
Same old game, same old thing. You never change, always rapping about the same old thing.
Constantly being interrupted in meetings, being talked over, being paid less for the same work, being told to be quiet, being bullied or harassed. These are the things that often happen to women in the workplace. And guess what? They are enraging. So where do we put these feelings? And what are some of the best strategies to handle these situations? Joining us as part of this week's long discussion on rage and women is Jeannie Yandel. She's the co-host of the podcast Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace from KUOW. And we started out by talking about her experience dealing with frustration on the job.
I can remember early on in my career, I had created a storytelling show outside of my workplace. This is something I was doing in my spare time. It got a little bit of media coverage. And then my boss at the time asked me to make a radio version, but said that I wouldn't be paid, except the exposure would be fantastic.
Oh, that old line, exposure.
Yes,
yeah,
the
exposure. You can't eat exposure, unfortunately.
I know. I couldn't pay my rent with exposure. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling so furious that there was this weird thing happening where I was being recognized for something I did, but that didn't mean I was going to be paid for it or that I was going to get any sort of increased work, anything beyond just more time actually working. And this was like 15 years ago. I never said anything to my boss, but here I am 15 years later, and I can still get in touch with that feeling of rage. And one reason I didn't say anything is because I was afraid if I expressed anger at all, I would be penalized, you know? And I think if I could go back in time, I would like to just say, that offer frustrates me, and here's why. Because the worst thing that was going to happen is I was still not going to make any money for my idea.
And so I guess the question is, like, I mean, I've been in similar situations where something has happened, you're angry about it, and you know, you sort of express it, even in non-rage form, if you will. You're just talking about, you know, how upset you are about this. And someone will say, well, it sounds like you still have a chip on your shoulder about that, which is always my favorite. Yes. One of the greatest hits, if you will.
Yes.
And I think a lot of women, at least that I know I've done this, you know, when you're frustrated in the workplace and someone makes a comment like that or says something, we tend to have a reaction which is, at least for me, I'm going to cry. How do we deal with this?
First and foremost, the research says that men don't judge us very harshly for crying. It's women who judge us the most harshly for crying. So there's something there. Maybe we can be a little bit easier on each other. But the tactics that I've heard that I really love are let a couple of tears flow, acknowledge in a neutral voice, you know, that really made me feel something. I'm having a reaction. I'd like to just take a moment and then move through. The thing that paradoxically does not work is apologizing for your tears. It's okay. I'm going to sound like that record, Free to Be You and Me, but it's okay to cry and it's okay to feel rage. It's just a matter of how we channel those emotions in the moment. And that's what so many of us have trouble with.
Jeannie, I am not just a woman, but I'm also a woman of color. And there is a real difference in how I think Black and brown women are perceived in the workplace versus white women. Are there unique strategies or things that we as women of color should be thinking about when we're trying to deal with these issues of anger and rage?
You know, that's a really good point, Tanzina. And the research that I've seen backs up your experience. I, as a white woman, have the privilege of being able to cry or have an emotion flare in the workplace, and I get called emotional or hysterical. Research shows that when women of color have that same experience, they get called angry, right?
Or which threatening or aggressive.
Threatening, yeah. Or intimidating, mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. of those words, which means they're dangerous, right? And that's, you know, that is not an equitable situation. But on our recent episode of Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, we had a guest named Keita Williams. She's a Black woman, and she talked about being in a meeting and literally being shushed by the man who was running the meeting. Like, he held his finger up and shushed her while she was presenting an idea. She felt a lot of rage in that moment. And what she learned from that experience is to calmly state what just occurred. You are merely recounting the reality that you just had. And that diffuses any potential for someone possibly calling you intimidating or angry, and then see what everyone else in the room has to say. In fact, Keita has become so used to being interrupted in meetings and getting angry at that, that she just makes little hash marks for the number of times she's been interrupted, and then very calmly lets the room know how many times she's been interrupted.
That's interesting. And I was wondering, does that help or hurt her in the long term?
I don't know if Keita would say that this is a 100% successful tactic all the time, but it does allow her to say, I'd like to be able to finish my thought, which then gives a possibility for action to other people in the room who are having the same experience.
Well, I want to play us some calls because we did ask our takeaway listeners to share their experiences with rage and anger in the workplace. And I'd like to play you some calls and get your reactions to them.
Hi, my name is Tanya and I'm calling from Tampa, Florida. The last time I expressed anger, I basically freaked everybody out who witnessed it, and I eventually just got out volume. So I guess I'm not supposed to get angry.
I mean, I would say to that caller, you are supposed to get angry. It's okay to get angry. It might feel amazing in the moment to pretend you're the Incredible Hulk and just smash as much as you can, but we have consequences in the real world. So what I'm hearing in that call is it's not so much about feeling the anger, it's about expressing anger.
And let's play you one more from Linda.
Hi, this is Linda from Portland. I complained to the chair of my department because he was not allowing me to teach a course using requirements that I alone get to decide within the guidelines of the college. As a result of my writing an angry letter asking why specifically he was intent on violating my academic rights, he turned my letter over to the administration, and the administration then sought an outside attorney to quote-unquote review fairly and neutrally the situation. So as a result of my anger, I was the person who was then turned against. And as a result of that, I decided ultimately to leave the job.
I feel like I hear a pattern in all those calls that I just listened to. And those women sound like they are incredibly bright, really accomplished, and frankly, their employers should be asking themselves, why are we willing to let these employees go? I mean, that's the other loss here. If women feel boxed in, like they can't be their full selves, which sometimes means feeling rage and expressing rage in a constructive manner, then that means workplaces aren't getting our full selves either.
And Jeannie, we are asking everybody we talked to this week if you have a favorite song by women to rage out to. We're creating a playlist.
Oh, I totally have a song.
Okay, what's your song? What is it?
The song is called Black Me Out, and it's by a band called Against Me.
Jeannie Yandel, thank you so much. The co-host of Battle Tactics for your Sexist Workplace podcast from KUOW. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I don't ever want to talk that way again. I don't want to know people like that anymore. As if there was an obligation. As if I owed you something. Black me out.
Check out the rest of it on our Spotify playlist. And if you have a song by a woman you like to rage to, tweet us at The Takeaway. And be sure to check out our other stories on the series at thetakeaway.org/womenrage. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.